welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. Today, my guest is Barbara Serinella. Barbara's been on before, and she's back with us with her eighth novel. Yeah. Let me turn you on. Eighth novel. She's author of the best-selling crime novels featuring Munch Mancini, who is a woman mechanic with a past. And her eighth book is An Unacceptable Death. Her books have made the Los Angeles Times bestseller list and fourth in the series, which was Unfinished Business.
Yes.
Was a Book Sense 76 pick for July, August 2001. And everybody always wants a Book Sense 76 pick. It was a national bestseller and picked as one of the best books of the year by the LA Times. Barbara's here in the studio. And again, her current book is An Unacceptable Death, published by St. Martin's Press. Hi.
Hi.
Good to see you again.
Yeah, good to be here.
Well, gosh, there's a lot to talk about, and we have you for an hour.
Oh, great.
Talk about An Unacceptable Death and how this particular book came about.
Well, Munch Mancini is a woman with a child and a job, and she had a criminal past and was a heroin addict and got straightened up in the first book and then keeps getting involved in these murder investigations. So I really didn't want her to be in a relationship that would give her any kind of a cushion. And she met a cop in the third book in San Diego. And then by the fifth book, that cop had been transferred to L.A., and they started a relationship. And at the end of that book, turns out his girlfriend from before was pregnant, so he had to do the honorable thing. And so I thought, good, I got rid of Rico, fine. And, both held their head up, and it was understandable separation. You know, she wasn't stupid for being involved with a jerk, and he wasn't a jerk in the end. So then I wrote my book last year, Unwilling Accomplice. And there's a body, of course, and when the cop comes around who's investigating it, who is it but Rico again? I'm like, there's no other cop in West L.A., you know? He just showed up. So he and Munch were still attracted to each other, and turns out the girlfriend wasn't pregnant after all. And I thought, well, okay, fine. I just let him have at it. You know, if you guys are so anxious to be together, just let him be together. And by the end of the book, he actually said, you know, I kind of want to marry you. And so this book, I thought, he's left me no choice. I'm going to have to kill him. So I was going to frame the book like Richard Price's book, The Samaritan, mm-hmm. which is a great book. And how it works is there are scenes before this teacher gets this very bad head injury and after when he's in the hospital. So you can see what's leading up to the event and you can see the cop trying to investigate it afterwards. And he doesn't want to say what happened to him or who did it. But the cop she's about to retire and she doesn't want to go out with an unsolved case. And then the end of the book, the time coalesces into what the actual incident where he gets beat up. And it was just a very cool way to frame mm-hmm, a book. Mm-hmm. So I thought I would do that before and after, you know, before he got killed, what he was like, what he was doing, who he was talking to, and the aftermath of her dealing with her grief and trying to find out the truth. Mm-hmm. And I did it for about three chapters. And I said, man, this is harder than it looks. But meanwhile, I'd never given Rico his own scenes because I never wanted him to be a continuing character. So in this book, now that I'm relaxed and I know he's not going to be a continuing character, I start writing him into scenes where he's speaking more and we get more of his point of view. And I really got to like him. So now I really felt bad because he's dead and I'm really liking him now. And but, you know, I had to go the course and stay
the
course.
So why didn't you want him to be a continuing character?
Because I wanted Munch to be single and mm-hmm. have to not have him to rely on. Mm-hmm. I wanted her to have to rise to the situation with only her own resources.
And I was unhappy that he died.
I was too.
But how is that? How is that too? And I was thinking, how do you kill off characters that you really like? And I have a really hard time doing that in my fiction. Nobody ever dies.
Yeah.
It's like they just stay alive forever because it's so difficult to do that. But
you know what?
To.
It raises the stakes. Mm-hmm. It increases the drama. You know, if you follow that Joseph Campbell, you know, hero's journey.
Yeah.
There comes a point where there's an unexpected death, and that just propels the story into a final conclusion. I mean, even in Star Wars,
sure.
when Luke Skywalker got his hand cut off, you're like, oh, how can that happen to, like, the star, you know?
Right.
Of course, it's in the future, so they, you know, make him a new hand that's just as good, if
right.
not better.
Right.
But, yeah, you have to do that every once in a while for the sake of the book. I think series that go on too long, they start killing everybody off, and it's like a snake eating mm-hmm. itself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to do that. I mean, there's some characters who I definitely couldn't get rid of, you
sure.
know. But I think you have to do that every once in a while, so because you know the main character isn't going to get killed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's already you've lost some suspense with that you would have in a standalone with the character.
Mm. So. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Barbara Serinella, who's author of An Unacceptable Death. Your title is quite interesting. Too, because of what you have been through.
I know.
You have been through the ringer since when? Last year this time?
Well,
or
I had,
you
know, I'm an ex-drug addict, and it's probably about 28, 30 years ago I contracted hepatitis C. And I've been sober about 28 years, but when I was sober, I got tested for it and knew that I had it, but it hadn't done any damage to me. And then oh, gosh, about 3 years ago, I got tested again and got a liver biopsy, and I had four-stage cirrhosis and four-stage hepatitis C. So I went on interferon, which is just miserable, mm-hmm. and I was already sick, and that didn't work. I couldn't keep doing it. So then I got on the transplant list. And then in June, I just started going downhill real fast, and in July, I had two transplants. And so it was actually, the timing was pretty good as far as the book publications, because I changed publishers. So normally mm-hmm. I have a book that comes out in May. Now it mm-hmm. came out in January. So it gave me time to have the surgery and go through the recovery and rehab and learn how to walk again and, you know.
My goodness. So then, and we started talking about this out in the lobby, and I didn't want to continue because then you said you would talk about this on the air. But an unacceptable death, then at what point were you at with it when you went in for your liver transplant?
I had written it, and I had written the next book, which is a standalone. And while I was in the hospital, because I had to go back to the hospital a lot after the transplant, I brought in my laptop one time, and they emailed me the copy, or they mailed me the copy edited manuscript. Mm-hmm. And to me, that last run-through is the easiest in the world. You mm-hmm. know, you don't have to create something new. You're just fixing stuff that they suggest. So I did that in the hospital and emailed it back.
For this book?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then the other book was already written, and I haven't gotten the editorial comments from it, but I did get a two-book deal from that book. So I just have to come up with another book by next December, which, I should be able to do. I haven't been writing. I didn't – when I got real sick, I developed – really bad tremors in my hands, and I couldn't drink a glass of water. Here I am at conferences or conventions on a panel, mm-hmm. and I've got my water in front of me with a straw because there's just no way I can get it to my mouth.
What was that? Why? I mean,
it's just the liver does so many functions in your body, and it was breaking down, and so I had a lot of different stuff going on. And then when I try to use the mouse, you know, mm-hmm. I could not. I was a mess. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, apparently the liver's pretty important.
I guess so.
Yeah. And then I went in the hospital in June, kind of the end of June. And they were just going to stabilize me, and I was going to go up to Davis and have the transplant. And then I just got worse and worse, and finally my breathing got bad, and they had to intubate me. And at that point, I went into a coma. It was like July 5th. And then on July 23rd, I recognized my mother in the room, and she said, oh, this is great. You see me, you know, and it's my birthday. And I'm like, July 23rd.
So you were in a coma that whole time?
Yeah, but I had a great coma. I did. I was in.
What's a coma like?
Well, my name was Sheba or Shauna, something like that. And I was like in my 20s. I was this bombshell. I wore spandex, and I had an eye patch and big mane of blonde hair. And I did, like, extreme sports, you know, like mountain biking and all this. And I led, like, adventure safaris through the jungles of Hawaii. But I also did prison breaks, you know, with helicopters and this mm-hmm. whole deal. So, and it went on day after day because I was unconscious day after day. So I had like this whole alter world going on. And then when I came to, my mom said, you know, you've had a transplant. You've had two transplants. And I thought, still in the hospital, you know, or in Hawaii. Well, you know, maybe she's got a point, you know. And then, you're coming back to reality was really hard. It was like, I'm pretty sure I'm married. What's his name? And does he have superpowers? Can he fly? You know, because anything was possible. So I was better off in a coma than I was recovering, you know. But
because, you know, the state of being when you're in a coma, nobody knows unless they've been in a coma. And a lot of people don't remember anything, or they remember people talking to them. And so
I might have responded to people talking to me, but I was not in this reality at all. I mean, you know, then I thought I was up in a ski lodge, an Indian-owned ski lodge, because it was cold in ICU, you know, and they asked me where I was, and I said, sports chalet. And then they said, who's the president? And I thought for a while, and I said, Jimmy Carter. And then they said, okay, what year is it? And I'm like, wait, I can get this one, you know, and then they just gave it to me anyhow.
But what's interesting about that is that your books take place in the past. You know, where there are different presidents.
And, yeah.
And you're coming through time in your series.
Yeah. No, it was, you know, I just had this thing with drugs, and I've always handled opiates very well, you know. And that's, some people have really bad hallucinations from opiates, and I coast. I have a good time. But, you know, if there's a side effect, I'll get it. If there's an addictive quality to it, yes, count me in. You know, sign me up. But, you know, it was interesting what you think you can survive and what you think is worth. You know, you kind of say to yourself, oh, if it gets that bad, I'll just kill myself. But when it really comes down to it, there's this, it's like being a parent and finding that well of patience that you never knew you'd have. And it's like when you're on the verge of death, there's this well of survival instinct that makes you, you know, fight. So, but I was about between the two livers. I was about as close to death as you're going to get and come back. So.
Well, I'm glad you're here.
Thank you. I am too.
You're listening to Writers on Writing, and Barbara Serinella is in the studio with us today. And her website, you might want to check it out. It's all kinds of stuff going on with her books and different things. It's BarbaraSerinella.com. Last name is SERANELLA.com. So check out her website and her books. So this is the eighth in a mystery series.
Yes.
And you're talking about two standalones, or one standalone.
It could be a series, actually.
So Munch isn't around?
No, it takes, like you said, my Munch books take place in the 80s. And so, actually, Munch has a niece who I brought her up to present time. Now she's 30. And in the book that we met her, she had OCD, you know, obsessive compulsive disorder. And she grows up to be a crisis management expert. So people hire her to write, like, crisis, you know, preparedness plans. And that's a piece of cake for her, because she naturally takes any situation and follows it through in her head to the worst possible conclusions. But her, but what else she does is when a company or a celebrity or whoever has a crisis situation, a PR fiasco, she gets called in by the attorneys. She signs a secrecy agreement, and then they have to tell her what happened. And then she has to find out why it happened, who was responsible, what plans were not in place, what, you know, who goofed up, where did the system break down, and how can we assure the public that it won't happen again? So it's a great venue for sleuthing, because she has to unwind this, and she can go to a different situation each time. So the first one was a train derailment from Orange County, L.A. to Palm Springs area, a passenger train, and it derails in Yucaipa. And I got great information from all kinds of people. I mean, I would mention that's what I was working on, and someone would say, oh, I have an old boyfriend that works for the NTSB. Here's his number. Or, oh, yeah, my brother investigates derailments. And I got to talk to all these people and, you know, engineers. And I went to the train yard, the coaster, and I spent about 2 hours with the manager there. And was, I had seen pictures of the cab of the train. I knew what the different controls did. But actually climbing up the ladder into the cab and seeing the different stuff and and noticing that the seat, all the stuffing's coming out because the train has a million miles on it. You know, just those little details are really great. So, and then, of course, after I wrote the book, all these trains started to derail. And I'm like, oh, I know what they're doing. I know what happened. You know, I felt a little bit responsible because I am all powerful. You know, I do create the universe, you know.
Too much. Well, before we go on, I wonder if you would read from your book.
Sure.
And again, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing and Barbara Serinella. Do you need this?
The book, yeah.
Barbara Serinella is with us, and she's about to read from An Unacceptable Death. And it's the eighth in a series.
Yeah, so I always think it's fair to start from the beginning, because that should stand on its own. Much like Rico's hair longer, she also dug the Fu Manchu mustache he had grown, but which she was glad he'd given up on the scraggly beard. Mexican men should stick to mustaches. It was Saturday. Asia, Munch's 9-year-old daughter, was at her dance class. Rico had surprised her with this visit, but that's the way they had to play it, snatching moments together when they could. They strolled down the sidewalk, Rico's arm resting comfortably on her shoulders. He was a foot taller than her own 5 feet. They fit together just right. If she had lived in a nicer neighborhood, she would have warned her neighbors that this vato-looking guy was really a cop and in disguise. But between the bikers across the street, the house full of probably illegal aliens next to them, the crazy Okie next door with the inbred daughter, and the alcoholic divorcee on the other side, it was probably safer for all concerned to say nothing. Her World War II vintage bungalow home was in Santa Monica, on a street lined with untrimmed palm trees and a few Spanish-style quasi-adobe houses that had seen better days. This part of Santa Monica was closer to the gangbangers of Venice than the pricey shops on Montana Avenue and the large stately homes on San Vicente Boulevard. Her little slice of real estate was far enough inland to be affordable on her auto mechanic's salary and whatever income could be eked from her limo business. If someone had told her 10 years earlier that she would one day be a homeowner, she would have wondered what they were on. Jasper walked ahead of Rico and Munch with his leash draped across his shoulders. The Cocker Spaniel looked back frequently to make sure the humans were keeping up. "I'm thinking of getting some tats," Rico said. He'd already pierced his ear and had taken to wearing a small gold sliver of a moon stud. She considered his brown skid and thought red would look good. "How about property of Munch on your ass?" "It's already on my heart," she laughed. "Good answer. I'm getting a lot of practice being quick on my feet." She shuddered against the chill his words brought. It was hard to think of him out there in the war zone. That world was dangerous enough without being a spy for the other side. She pulled away from him and folded her arms across her chest. "How much longer?" she asked, trying to sound neither impatient nor worried or upset. "I can't say." She nodded, knowing that she would have to be content with that answer and feeling anything but. He put his arm back around her shoulders and pulled her close. "How long we got before the kid comes home?" "That I can answer." She made a hand signal to Jasper and it was time to turn around and head home. "The better part of an hour." "I can give you that," he said, picking up Jasper's leash. Uh-oh. Munch spotted a pit bull coming their way. The dog was secured by a short chain to its equally short master. Both were bandy-legged and full of attitude. Enemy approaching. Jasper was still in happy-go-lucky mode, tail up, mouth open in a dog smile, black eyes liquid and trusting. The pit bull had scars across his face and back. As he approached, his muscles rippled beneath his short hair. Munch knew the breed had a bite like a piranha, and once they'd sunk their teeth in their prey, it was darn near impossible to make them let go. She'd seen the biker across the street use a 4-inch nail punch like a hood prop when his mastiff got a hold of another neighbor's cat. Jasper finally spotted the approaching danger. He puffed out his chest, straightened his forelegs, and pawed the sidewalk with alternating back legs like a bull getting ready to charge. The hair along his spine sprouted into a mohawk, and he barked his deep boy bark. Rico pulled the leash in tight and waited for the other dog to approach. The pit bull and his master drew alongside them and then stopped. As both dogs snarled and stamped at each other, the two men shortened their leashes, and the dogs responded by rising up until both were on their hind legs, lips curled back to reveal sharp white teeth. Munch wondered why neither of the men didn't just keep walking on his way, ending the encounter that much sooner. It would be logical, as if logic dictated the behavior of males in the wild. She also knew Rico wouldn't back down first.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
It was Barbara Serinella reading from An Unacceptable Death, published by St. Martin's. How much do you know? I think I've asked you this a million times, but I'll ask you again because we have new listeners all the time.
Of course.
How much do
and
you
I might change my answer.
How much do you know before you begin? With literary fiction, for instance, a lot of writers don't necessarily plot.
Mm-hmm.
Mystery writers tend to plot a lot more and tend to know the plot points and outline and,
yeah.
you know what's going to happen.
I'm not one of those. I mean, I know the inciting incident. I know who the dead body was going to be. Why he died or who killed him, I don't know yet. And I really don't know a lot because I have to write the characters and see how they shape up. So, I mean, I know it involved the cocaine trade of the 80s. And I talked to, like, DEA agents and I talked to cocaine dealers and, you know, got more background that shifted the stories different ways. And then I started including the neighbors around her and the different forces involved, the connection in down in Mexico. I read an article in the newspaper, the local newspaper out in the desert, and it said that the cops had pulled over this guy because he had the obvious signs that he was in the drug business, but the paper wouldn't say what those signs were. So I asked a cop friend of mine, what are the signs? And he says, well, a lot of air fresheners, a single key in the ignition, and then there's a patron saint of dope dealers, and there's a medal for him. And if that's hanging from the rearview mirror, that's kind of a good giveaway, too.
Really?
And I thought, that's great, a patron saint of dope dealers. I love that. So I learned about this guy and his shrine in Sinaloa, and he was sort of like a Robin Hood, you know, of mm-hmm. Mexico. And, you know, the police aren't the good guys down there, and the job to aspire to is dope dealer, you know, because that's the ones having the money mm-hmm. and the good clothes and the good cars and stuff. So... he was a bandit, but he stole and gave to the poor was the story, and that's why he became this saint of the outlaws. And people go and burn candles and play tapes and, you know, praying for a safe passage north or that they won't get shot again, you know, that kind of thing. So anyhow, and then I got into patron saints. So it just sort of evolves like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I get to probably – and the whole time I'm cogitating what happened next and who are these people and what really happened here and trying to pull the memory of – what happened out of, you know, the ether. And then I stop and I write down all the characters that I've introduced and created. And I figure out what they know, what they did, and what they want. So the ending of this book I'm particularly proud of because I had about six different factions, all with different agendas. And they all meet together in front of Munch's house for a final showdown. And while I wrote that scene, my heart beat fast. You know, it took a couple days to write it. And every time I sat down and started reading it and getting into it, my heart would beat fast. The first person to read the manuscript was my agent. And she usually, the first pass is pretty critical and usually wants me to make these major changes that I talk her out of. But her first comment was, wow, what an ending. Then I thought, great. That's great because, you know, every part
Excellent.
Of the book is important. In the beginning, you have to not bore readers, but you have to catch them up on mm-hmm. who the character mm-hmm. is, and you have to introduce some action right away. The middle, you don't want it to sag. You don't want people to skip. But you want to have a bang-up ending so that they're left really satisfied and can't wait to read your next book.
One.
You know,
interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with more Barbara Serinella. So don't go away. Keep your computer on KUCI.org or your radio station on 88.9. We'll be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. know, little darling, one month built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
None of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
Yee-haw! The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And welcome back to 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we have been here since 5 o'clock Pacific time with Barbara Serinella, author of many books, including An Unacceptable Death, her most recent, published by St. Martin's Press. Hello again. Here we are. In the first half, toward the end of the first half, you talked about, did I make a note about it? I think I made a note about it, so let me see. I know what you were saying. You were talking about the ending of the book, and you said that when you wrote the ending of An Unacceptable Death, you felt your heart sort of pick
raise,
up.
Yeah.
And so I started thinking, how much do you pay attention to your own physical response to your work? Does that tell you if something's working or not working? Or sometimes do you just not have a clue and somebody else reads it and says, this is great? Or do you always kind of know, even if you don't necessarily want to look at it?
I know when a scene is very powerful, and I do have physical reactions to it. Sometimes it's so honest that I'm kind of cringing, but I am writing fiction. So, you know, I'm presenting it as fiction, but, you know, it's very raw stuff from me. And, maybe something I feel guilty about or some horrible situation I was in once. And I remember reading a scene. These people had been involved in this triple murder. Mm-hmm. And they're all doing a bunch of cocaine, and they had the radio on, waiting for the news of the murder to come on the radio. And which is not exactly what happened to me, obviously, but there was a close enough situation to that. And when I read it to my critique group, I mean, you could have heard a pin drop, and it was just that powerful. And then there's other times when I'll read something and I'll want to cry, it's hard for me not to read it because I get choked up. Or, you know, on the other end, you know, maybe a real sensuous scene, I'll react physically to that, you know, and tell my husband, hey, I want to read you something. <You know? laughs> Yeah. So, I think you have to trust your gut. And I think when you're getting bored with the work, that's a real danger sign. Because if you're bored writing it, why do you expect someone to be interested reading it?
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah, I think sometimes that's a hard one for writers because do you pay attention to your critique group, your writing buddy? Do you pay attention to how you respond? And what about when you're bored with what you're writing? Mm-hmm. and then you someone else reads it and says, this is great, then what do you do?
If I was bored with it, nobody could tell me anything. Mm-hmm. You know, I would know that some action would have to happen right there. I guess you get an instinct about it from reading a lot and writing a lot, and you just sort of know. It's like when your character does something that's out of character. It's going to bother you.
Yeah.
And then you have to, and on another point, that's why it's important to put words down on the paper, because then you have something to fix.
Mm-hmm.
And then you write it down, and it rings false to you, and you go, why does it ring false? Well, what would she really do? You know, and then you can fix it, but you've got something to work with. The hardest thing is creating something new from a blank page, and that's the most taxing part of writing, really.
We were in a free writing group once together, mm-hmm. and I remember you writing something during the free writing group, and later I read it in one of your books.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious how much you use free writing to
I used to use it a lot, and what was fun about that, we would sit down with, we'd have a prompt, you know, which might be cantaloupe, it might be a race car, whatever, on a piece of paper, and then we'd pick it out of the basket, everybody would put prompts in. And I was running the meetings, and I had a watch with a minute hand, and I'd say, okay, 3 minutes on cantaloupe.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just write, just without any correction, just stream of consciousness. And then you kind of warm up. And then, because when I'm writing a book, I'm always thinking about the book. So a topic comes up, and then I might go back to the characters of the book and what's happening in the book at that time. But because it's not, you're not typing it into your computer and expect it to be finished work.
Mm-hmm.
You can play with it.
Mm-hmm.
And one time the topic was God. And I already knew what Munch's feelings on God were, but I was doing a lot of that book from this cop, May St. John's point of view. And I'd never explored what he thought about God. So, and it was like a 15-minute session.
Mm-hmm.
So I played out with Munch, and you're not supposed to pick up your pen. You're supposed to just keep writing, not
right.
correct, not worry about grammar, not worry about spelling. So then I just segued into May St. John, and it was interesting because mm-hmm. I came up with stuff I hadn't thought about and wouldn't have played with
mm-hmm.
because I would be thinking, oh, got to move the plot forward. We've got to keep the action coming. We've got
right.
to do this and do that. So it really frees you to try something new and experiment.
Mm. Yeah.
Nice creative tool.
Yeah. You know, there's all this. Talk, especially the last couple of days, on what constitutes fiction
mm-hmm.
and what constitutes nonfiction,
and or memoir,
and then when you get into nonfiction and memoir, what can you get away with?
Mm-hmm.
How much can you embellish? So on and so forth. So much of you is in your book. You were an auto mechanic. You have this drug past. You know a lot of the people who mm-hmm. are in this book. And yet, you wrote it as fiction.
And I also wrote it in third person.
And in third person. Why not memoir? Had it occurred to you at any point to do that? And
well, you know,
how did you choose fiction?
Listen, I came from a nice background. I grew up in Pacific Palisades. I had a lot of advantages. And then I ran away from home and I lived on the streets. How sympathetic is that? So let's take a character who was raised by, has a dead mom and raised by this reprobate dope dealer pimp guy, and she's in Venice, you know, and she has no net, as it were, you know. How much more sympathetic is she than someone who took cotillion classes and threw it away to panhandle on Hate Street, you
right.
know, and which is really my story. And I wanted to play around with the facts and stuff, but I get confused sometimes. Like, one time I told this little boy that I knew when I was about 6 months sober, that I didn't drink or use anymore. And he was 7. And he was trying to figure that out. And he was walking in and out of the kitchen. And he came back and he says, oh, so that's far out. We won't have to wake you up in the bathtub anymore. And what he was remembering is me ODing on heroin and being put in a cold bathtub with ice cubes to try to revive me. And one time, they couldn't. And they took me to the hospital and the cops there charged them with murder. I mean, you know, because I was that far gone.
Mm-hmm.
So I had some experience with this. Anyhow, when I used that dialogue, because it was like that kid just saved my life. You know, mm-hmm. that was just really great. It was like God speaking through this kid to me right when I needed it. I used that with these two little girls in the book. And then later I used this boy character that was sort of loosely based on the boy who'd actually said that. And Munch was going to say to him, well, the last time I saw you, you saved my life. And then I had to go, no, that was real. I have to go back to what I wrote in the book and stick to that, you know. So that gets confusing. I also, you know, my parents are still married and still alive. So, you know, I have two brothers. So Munch doesn't have any of the same family I have. So there's no confusion there,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I'm just writing about this person that I imagine from some people I met who were, like, raised in Venice by these, you know, old-time bikers and stuff. And a woman I met in jail who had been arrested for murder. And then I just threw in enough of feelings from how I felt when things were going on,
mm-hmm.
you know, just evolved from there. So mm-hmm. she's not really me.
Mm-hmm.
And even now, my agent said, gee, we should make a movie of your life. And I said, wait till my dad's dead, you know, by his request, you know. But I already feel like I've used so many segments from my life
right.
that a memoir at this point would be repetitive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know,
New stuff is coming in all the time. So, who knows?
But sometimes it seems that you can tell more of the truth in writing fiction.
Sure. Absolutely. It's like I say, there's no place to hide behind I.
Right.
So you use it third person. You can describe this person without telling good qualities, without looking like you're bragging about yourself, mm-hmm. you know. And tell the real awful stuff, you know, without feeling totally exposed,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, I don't know, you know, I have people in my life that I think would be embarrassed by some of the stuff I've done. So that's not, I just don't make that public knowledge.
Yeah.
You know?
Is your next book first person or third?
Third.
Third person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just more comfortable that way. I like to switch point of views, although... Mm-hmm. Lately, it seems like my protagonists are practically in every scene, so I could almost write it first person, but I'm just more comfortable with third person, I think.
You've talked about this before, that you had written a couple of books previous to the first Munch Mancini book.
Mm-hmm.
One I think, was about a woman who gets divorced. Another was a World War II story.
Yeah.
And
one science fiction book, actually.
And a science fiction book,
mm-hmm.
too. And nothing much happened with those books until Munch. And you talked about what somebody said to you and how you really came to write Munch. Do you remember that story? You said a screenwriter told you.
Yeah, they said if he was, my neighbor was taking screenwriting classes at UCLA. And the teacher, who was a very famous guy, and my neighbor brought me notes from the class. He says, if you're looking for a plot, take a blank piece of paper and write down an event that changed your life. So, you know, you can only dig so deep the first, there's layers that you have to get through in your psyche before you can tell your story. So I had my first book that just wandered all over the place, kind of based on my father-in-law, an Italian who was mafia but was in World War II and all this stuff. And not that my father-in-law was mafia. anyhow.
Fiction.
Fiction, yes. And then he meets a lady auto mechanic that had nothing to do with the plot of the story, but because I was late, I threw that in there. And then I wrote a book about my divorce, but I made it a murder mystery where the guy gets killed, and there's so many suspects because he was such a jerk. you know. And that one, I remember the editor saying, but why was she married to him? Mm-hmm. He was such a jerk. Was she stupid? You know, thank God it was fiction, right? Thank God it was like 4 years in the book and 9 years in real life. You want to talk about stupid, but anyhow. But so I thought, well, people have been divorced. I mean, that's not big breaking news. And mm-hmm. it actually took me a couple of years to say, what do I know that mm-hmm. other people don't know?
Mm-hmm.
And what I know is what it's like from living on the street and being a biker outlaw chick and a hippie and all that.
Sure.
And getting sober and learning how to live in the straight world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I was a hippie in Haight-Ashbury, I would go months without seeing a straight person, you know, because I could just do all my business mm-hmm. within that community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all I'd see were hippies and freaks, you know, and it was just culture shock to go downtown and see people in suits, you know. Of course, that's where the good panhandling was. But so I finally got down to, oh, yeah, kicking heroin, you know, that mm-hmm. lifestyle. And I started as a short story. based on this murderer I met in jail, and I just had all this inside information about what it feels like to want to get off dope and not be able to, and you know how you make these commitments, and then the longer it's been since your last fix, the more those commitments sort of wobble, and then you're like, well, maybe I'll taper off, and you know, and then I framed it in a murder mystery. Well, not the short story, but then after the people who read that were really like blown away by it and the intimacy of it and the just freshness of it. So then I made it into a novel, and it was received very well. So I was on it, you know, I just kept writing that character.
So all of that writing, all of those years into those other books, did you ever think that was a waste of time, or was it necessary to bring you where you were? I mean, how do you feel about all that time in retrospect?
Well, you know, compared to a lot of people, it wasn't that long at all. It felt like a long time. Mm-hmm. And then at the time, I'd say, if I could just get a short story published somewhere, I would be content. Well, the bar soon raised from that. Now I'm just like, if I could just get a multi-million-dollar movie deal, I would be content, you know. I remember having No Human Involved written. And I didn't really send out the other books because I knew they weren't right. I knew they weren't coherent. But I sent out 30 pages of No Human Involved, and an agent asked to see the rest. Oh, did I get excited. Or I sent the cover letter and a synopsis, and she asked to see the first 30 pages. Oh, I was so excited. You know, and I printed them up, and I put them in the mail and sent them off, and I get them back, and they didn't even look like they'd been leafed through. You know, they were all just still stuck together in just a nice format, like I'd mailed them. And it just said in pencil on the front, sorry, I'll pass. Oh, God, was I depressed. Mm-hmm. And we're driving up Laguna Canyon, and my husband says, well, you know what? I'll buy you some more of those bubble envelopes. They're expensive. And I'm like, why do you always have to talk about money? You know, this is, you know, and I just unglued on them. But it didn't really take that long. And I knew I had something with that, with No Human Involved, and I met an agent, and she wanted to see the rest. I met her face-to-face at a conference, and then she had it. I met her in January, and she had it sold by February. So, not that much money, but, you know, it was getting published, so that was pretty exciting.
Sure. What about all of that? What about marketing and selling? Is that something that concerns you? Are you ever thinking about that when you're writing? At what point do you think about, you know, is this book marketable? Is my agent going to like it? Are my readers going to like it? Mm-hmm. Or do you just leave that alone?
I get a lot of feedback from readers. And if I think they have a good idea or a point, you know, I'll use it. And my agent and I don't always see eye to eye. So I don't really worry about that so much. And then I have to be satisfied with it. And then I think about, marketability. Like this last book had much more of an action edge to it than other books, which are a little bit more introspective. But it happened organically, and I thought, great, you know, and that's what people kind of want in a thriller mystery kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I was very driven for a long time. I wanted to be, you know, bestseller. I wanted to be up there with the biggies. I wanted movie deals and TV deals, and I just lived and breathed everything. I mean, I didn't write a note that didn't have some angle to it, you know, of selling the books, or, you know, I'd go places or join organizations and let it be known that I was a writer and stuff. And then, you know, when I was looking at death, it just really changed my perspective on a lot of things. And I just relaxed about it. Mm-hmm. And when we sold the books, I was just so grateful to be published and that people were going to read what I wrote. Mm-hmm. You know, the money wasn't an issue, any of that. And, you know, because I wrote both those books on spec. I mean, I didn't have contracts and sold them both. So that's was very gratifying. And even now I'm on tour and I'm still kind of, you know, recovering. So I'm not like killing myself, going to every bookstore in the world saying, do you have one book here? I'll sign it, you know, trying to talk people into it. I'm being a little bit more relaxed about it. When the mystery community is so supportive, and when I was sick, I got just eulogized on the internet, and I just got so many cards and flowers, and just so many nice people did things for me. And I was just so overwhelmed. I felt so loved. Mm-hmm. And I went to a mystery convention in Chicago 6 weeks after the surgery to show them that the prayers worked, and here I was. And I still had tubes hanging down.
Oh, my gosh.
And I just soaked up the love. You know, mm-hmm. people were just, like, hugging me and stuff. I did have one disappointment. I was Harlan Coben was the Toastmaster, mm-hmm. and I had written an appreciation of him for the program. So he says, be at the opening ceremony tonight because I'm going to give you a shout-out. So I'm up in my room, and I'm putting makeup on and getting dressed and stuff, and I'm thinking, I wonder if they're going to give me a standing ovation, you know? And so I go down, and I'm standing in the back of all the chairs, and Harlan's talking, and he says, and the greatest time of my weekend was seeing Barbara Serinella and seeing her up around. That's just made my weekend, you know? And everybody starts to clap, and they turn around, and I'm waiting. And, like, one person in the corner stood, and I'm waiting. And, you know, they never stood. And I was complaining to Steve Cannell about it, and he says, yeah, you got to seed the audience. You got to put people in the front row that stand, then everybody behind them, you know, follow suit. I thought, well, you know, live and learn, right?
So. Applause sounds pretty good.
Oh, what?
Yeah. Applause.
Oh, you know, really, I was just, it was really nice. And I was pretty frail, too, and people mm-hmm. were just hugging me gently and, you know. People with colds were staying away. Mm-hmm. I gave away onions.
Onions?
Yeah. Said, I'll keep the liver. You can have the onions. Gave away about 150 onions.
Oh. Gosh. You're listening to Writers on Writing at KUCI 88.9 FM. We have a few more minutes left with Barbara Serinella. Give your website again.
It's www.barbaraserinella.com. And the spelling of Serinella is Serenella. You can even see a picture of the scar if you go on.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I didn't see that.
Just like the old day, I'm pulling up my shirt at a whim, you know?
Oh, Barbara. I wrote down here declarative sentences. When I read your work, I remember something you said a long time ago about your writing style, because it's very clean, you know, very punchy. And I think the your short sentences, well, your varied sentence length, but you have a lot of short sentences that kind of speed the action
mm-hmm.
and make your work extremely readable. Will you talk about that? Do you remember talking about
that?
You
know, I just finished reading a book that was good, but the guy used a lot of big vocabulary words and a lot of adjectives, and he would stop to describe a scene that really didn't have to do with the action and use these metaphors and stuff. And, you know, I use metaphors and similes, and I do use some adjectives and adverbs. But for the most part, you know, as I'm writing it, I'm picturing what's going on. I see it like a movie streaming in my head.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm reporting what I'm seeing. And I don't want to stop the flow for a big vocabulary word that, you know, does that impress someone? I don't know. But if you don't know what that word means, it stops the flow. It stops your reading. And so, you know, there's different ways authors will show off. You know, they did a lot of research on this topic. So they want to show you all the stuff they learned about the topic. But how much is pertinent to the story? How much serves the story? So you got to go back and say, nope, this is just something I know that it's not important the reader know, you know, or...
So how much research do you do? Because you weren't a cop. You were on the other side of all of that.
But, you know, I actually know a lot of cops who talk to me. And whatever, you know, I need to know for the sake of the story. Like, for instance, when I was going the drug trade, I went to someone I know used to deal a lot of weight, a coke. And I'm like, well, how did you test it for purity? You know, what was your process there? And, you know, talk to DEA agents and, you know, how the dope was, like, branded by how it was packaged or whatever, and you know, so I learned a lot of details like that. And I talked to a cop who was working undercover, had worked undercover, and his wife owns a bookstore in Arizona, or in Texas, actually. And he was talking about they had this stolen car ring, and they needed to get this guy's name instead of just his moniker on the street. So he pulls out a pen, but it's not a pen, it's just a refill for a ballpoint pen. And he says to the guy, hey, I got to get your name and your driver's license number because I need you to transport cars from San Antonio to Dallas, you know. But instead of having like a nice ballpoint pen and a pad of paper. You know, he's got a scrap of paper, he rips off of something, and his refill, you know, and but he gets the guy's name and mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, driver's license number. And those little details, right, and I've had so many comments about that, using the refill, right, like, you know, a street person would rather than an mm-hmm organized cop. You know, mm-hmm, I mean, I was in a few situations when I knew the guys were cops, you know, in an undercover kind of thing, and they're like, they make eye contact and they say, "How are you today?" It's like, that's not the way we used to talk, right, you know. So, kind of a dead giveaway. Mm-hmm. So, but whatever it is, I try to go there. I try to walk there. I try to talk to people who do that thing and hear the different idiosyncrasies in their speech and, you know, how they would describe mm-hmm something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I try to make it so that if someone in that field were to read the book, they would go, "Oh, yeah, she got that right." Mm-hmm.
We're at the end of our time.
Went fast.
It went fast. Yeah. Any last words for the readers listening? Advice for maybe writers kind of struggling through a draft?
Mm-hmm. Know your narrative thread. I mean, know what your end point is. A story is very simple. A story is one main character with one objective and all the people that help him or hinder him in between. But you got to have that through line so that when you start to get off track, you go, "Well, wait a minute, what is this character trying to achieve here?" And then you can get back on track.
Hmm. Purpose, huh? Thank you.
Thank you
so much for being here. Barbara Serinella, author of An Unacceptable Death. Her website is www.barbarasarinella.com. So visit her website. You can read about her books and see her scar and all sorts of things. And we are at the end of our time. You can also visit my website, which is penonfire.com, and email me if you'd like to be on my weekly email list where I let you know the morning of the show who's going to be on. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Stephen King, who said, "Fiction is the truth inside the lie." Thanks for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. Thank you again, Barbara, for coming on the show. And all of you out there, come back next week. More great guests and another great show. Thanks for listening.